And there is no one that does it better than the Macho Man Randy Savage. On balance, off balance, doesn't matter. I'm better than you are, yeah.
That, of course, is a monologue by Macho Man Randy Savage. Although the clip is fairly old, it's typical of the pompous, parading, neon pyrotechnics that have made professional wrestling so popular in America. But for all that silliness and its dismissal as lowbrow by many, professional wrestling has many, many dark sides. In fact, as writer Dan O'Sullivan points out, quote, "The billion-dollar spectacle of pro wrestling relies entirely on the ruthless economic, mental, and physical exploitation of its performers." He's called his article about the terrible treatment of pro wrestlers by the WWE and the company's predecessors, Money in the Bank. It was published in Jacobin magazine. I'm very pleased to welcome Dan to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Thank you for having me.
When you say that pro wrestlers are exploited, can you explain how that works?
Well, I guess it runs the gamut. First thing is that, in the world of wrestling entertainment, no wrestler is an employee of the WWE.
They're independent contractors?
That's correct, yeah. What that means is they have the putative protections of a contract without most of the benefits. So that would mean, for instance, any wrestler who signs with WWE, they will not be allowed to compete. They won't be allowed to wrestle for other outfits. But WWE can terminate that contract at any time, pretty much. That's the main one that really keeps a grip on all the wrestlers, and it really is pretty coercive.
Do they have to pay for their health and life insurance and pension plans and all of that out of pocket?
That's correct. WWE does not pay for health insurance, anything like that. They don't pay into Social Security, unemployment, Medicare. They don't pay pensions. And what Vince McMahon, the chairman of WWE, would say is that, you know, the wrestlers that we have, they can pay for health insurance out of their own pockets. The fact of the matter is a lot of them can't, especially when they're out of contract and really don't have don't have a way to make a livelihood.
But is that any different from the way professional boxing is structured, or golf, or tennis, for that matter?
Well, I think, for instance, if you look at, if you compare, this with the NFL, for instance, or some of these other organizations, NFL, for instance, has a strong players union and has provisions like pensions, like health insurance, concussion testing, that just aren't present in wrestling. They have a wellness policy which covers some of this, but I'd say that the big difference between wrestling and these other sports is that to a marked degree compared to other ones, wrestlers are just way worse off by the end of the ride and don't have some of the same protections that these other athletes would have.
Now, there have been attempts to unionize the wrestlers, but they have failed. And you write that most wrestlers have been happy to take what they can get.
I think that's true, and I think the reason for that is that the governing logic is one of fear. And the most notable unionization attempt was in 1986. That was when Jesse Ventura, who later would go on to be governor of Minnesota, he attempted to unionize wrestlers ahead of WrestleMania II, this huge spectacle that they were going to have. He viewed it as a time that they had the most leverage. And ultimately what happened in that was actually, of all people, Hulk Hogan informed on those efforts to the management, who promptly threatened everyone involved and managed to crush it. The result was you haven't really seen a serious unionization drive since. You will occasionally see retired wrestlers speaking in hindsight that unionization is a good idea, but no active unionization work.
Hulk Hogan was the face of pro wrestling in the United States for a long time. Should I assume that he and other wrestlers at the top are compensated differently than the rest of them?
That's absolutely right, Leonard. So, for instance, the available salary data is spotty at times, but for instance, if you look at the contracts today, the data we do have, current stars like say John Cena are being paid in the millions, And then lower on the card, most of the what we call mid-carders, all the female wrestlers, for instance, it's five figures. And out of those five figures, you know, these people are expected to pay, like I said, health insurance, not just health insurance, but also travel to any shows around the country. So airfare, hotels, dining, and, of course, gym memberships.
And you suggest that there's always been wage fixing in wrestling.
Yeah, that's correct, and it goes back really to the earliest days. You know, after World War II, wrestling promoters formed this organization called the National Wrestling Alliance, which really I call it a cartel. You know, it's a classic kind of trust. And the way it would work is that these promoters in this organization would collude to drive down prices, drive down wages, and basically have a compliant labor pool. And there were various devices they would use to ensure that, not the least of which was the blacklist and refusing to hire wrestlers who were in any way recalcitrant.
Just how physically punishing is a career in pro wrestling?
Oof, yeah. One study that was cited by the journalist David Shoemaker in his book, The Squared Circle, which is excellent, I think this is a good way of looking at it. Your average football player, they're maybe going to play, you know, in a game in the NFL about 16 times a year. And if this study is correct, wrestling in a match is roughly equivalent to playing in one NFL game. The difference is that you play or you wrestle 200 nights a year or more even. The result is that if you get a concussion, there's really no rest between concussions. I mean, the fact of the matter is lifelong pain is just going to be a part of it if you're a wrestler. And I think all wrestlers know that, that, you know, lingering pain is a problem, which leads to all sorts of problems with painkillers and the very staggeringly short life expectancy of most professional wrestlers.
Do injured wrestlers receive any financial support when they are in recovery? If they've broken a bone or something and they can't be rushed back into the ring?
Right. There was a famous incident in the 90s where Bret Hart, who was one of the stars of WWE at that time, actually broke his sternum in the match. And, you know, later said that, you know, he was out for a little while, a few weeks, but he was only getting paid about $200 a week and ultimately had to come back, you know, shortly after the serious injury. A lot of wrestlers historically have played on injuries. I think it's a little better now. The WWE, I think, recognizes more the cost of this. So they will provide, for instance, they have this wellness policy which provides some limited health care and also will provide drug rehabilitation to former employees. But Vince McMahon is very open and testified to Congress that the reason that he was doing that was, in his words, two words, public relations, that there had been such a staggering number of overdoses that they needed to get a lid on it.
Is part of the problem that some people object to even calling it a sport? I've always thought of wrestling matches as fake. In fact, I haven't. Everybody does. Can certain wrestling moves, despite the fact that it's all choreographed, done incorrectly or not, cause major physical damage?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, what any wrestler would tell you is that when they hit the mat, they feel it. And, you know, they can, you know, they are terrific technicians. These guys are really talented in what they do. But it doesn't change the fact that, you know, you will feel it.
And then they get smashed on the head with chairs. They do bleed. Bleeding usually suggests that there's been some damage done.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, Chris Benoit, who was a WWE star, was known for taking chair hits to the back of the head, which many wrestlers won't do. And, you know, at the time of his very violent death, before which he also murdered his wife and son, he was found to have, I mean, the autopsy showed he had the brain of an 85-year-old Alzheimer's patient. So there is an undeniable toll that's taken. And you know, the fact that when I was doing this article, I wrote a list of all wrestlers who had died an untimely death. And what was amazing to me was that it filled two pages. And only one of them was over 50, which I think has got to tell you something about this industry.
So they're dying at a much higher rate than the national average.
Yeah, that's a 538 study on 538 found that that they died well above the average of just the average American, not even athlete. You know, it was it really is a staggering number of people who've died. And any wrestling fan can tell you if they're watching an old match, you know, both these guys are dead, or all of these. You know, all these guys on the sidelines are dead. It's really pretty scary.
I'm talking with Dan O'Sullivan, whose article, Money in the Bank, was published by Jacobin Magazine. It's about the problems in professional wrestling. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Ludit Lopate. Is part of the problem that since people don't take wrestling seriously, they don't take the working conditions of the sport seriously?
I think that's correct, and you know, there's this whole subculture, what they'd call kayfabe, where it's a carnival term originally, but it refers to the idea of kind of not breaking character. And when you watch wrestling, it's obviously it seems silly, you know, it's you know, you have the you know, feather boas and bizarre dancing and all this stuff, you know, it's a cartoonish. But what I say is that's kind of the best angle that they ever sold, because the fact is, if you're not taking this seriously, it enables promoters to make much more money with much less scrutiny.
You note that wrestling is less scrutinized and more popular than boxing. Mm-hmm. Don't wrestlers compete in many more matches? Well, you said 200 a year. That no boxer mm-hmm. would do anything like that. And wrestling has had a serious steroid problem. Is that still the case?
So, I mean, the steroid issue, I think people forget Vince McMahon actually was tried by the federal government in 1994 on charges that essentially the WWE had been engaged in drug trafficking. You had a doctor in Pennsylvania who was shipping steroids, or I should say rather packages, to hotels, to WWE headquarters in Connecticut, and then several wrestlers testified that they were receiving steroids from this doctor. McMahon was acquitted ultimately, but steroids were undeniably a huge issue. They have, like I said, a wellness policy in place now, which provides for steroids testing. However, it is not independent of the corporation. You know, there are rumors that the star wrestlers are exempted from some of the provisions and some of the testing. But I will say this much for them. On paper, at least, the wellness policy is a better steroid policy than even some other major sports leagues.
If wrestling is fake and we know who's going to win in advance, why was there even a demand for steroids?
Right. Well, that's a good question. I guess you'd have to go back to the kind of image that Vince McMahon started to try to create in the early 80s. What he was creating was what he calls sports entertainment. And that's his kind of catch-all for his type of wrestling. What he wants is something that is pop culture, that can be shown on MTV as it was in the early 80s, or rather tied into MTV and Cyndi Lauper and all this, you know, all these music videos and that kind of thing, and become kind of a crossover sensation. And part of the way that you do that is by moving away from the older types of wrestling, where it's a little grittier, it's largely, in many cases, Southern, like Georgia Championship Wrestling, moving away from that and moving into, you know, the kind of the, you know, muscle man like Hulk Hogan or Ultimate Warrior, where these guys have cartoonish physiques. And that's the kind of ethos he was going for. And the aesthetic is paid for, however, and was paid for through massive amounts of steroids.
You mentioned Chris Benoit before, and that his brain looked like somebody who had Alzheimer's. The medical examiner also found 59 times the amount of normal testosterone in his system. Was that the result of steroid abuse?
Yes. Irv Muchnick, who's a journalist who covers this, he concluded looking over the documents that Benoit's body was, in fact, he had abused steroids so thoroughly that his body was no longer capable of producing normal amounts of testosterone. And so the result was, you have this perfect storm of a man with severe CTE, severe brain damage, who cannot produce testosterone and is just injecting it nonstop. Chris Benoit's father said that Chris Benoit was not the person he knew, and I 100% believe him. He was a totally changed person at that point.
I'm assuming that there are other kind of substance abuse problems in pro wrestling, mm-hmm. painkillers, for example, because people are fighting in pain.
Yeah.
Are drug overdoses common?
Very common. Very common, unfortunately. And drug abuse contributes to other – it doesn't have to be a direct overdose. Heart attacks are probably the most common killer, and obviously, cocaine abuse or painkiller abuse, alcohol abuse, all these things can add to that. It's absolutely a problem. The one that comes to mind for me is, Eddie Guerrero, who was a very popular wrestler, battled both alcohol and painkiller issues and ultimately did die of a heart attack. The fact is, the best way I heard it described by a wrestler was, imagine being in constant pain such that you're unable to fall asleep. And then if you take a pill or you have a few drinks, it goes away and you can sleep. I don't think it's difficult to see how that would ensnare a lot of wrestlers. Now, Vince McMahon says he has no responsibility for people who pick up a drug and use drugs. And, I think if you look at the record, the fact is it is, intrinsically tied to the rigors of the sport.
Considering how poorly they're paid and what can happen to them, why do so many people wind up going into wrestling? Who's likely to go into it?
Well, I don't say this to denigrate their talents in any way because I really have a lot of respect for wrestlers, but in many cases it is guys who they're kind of misfits in some sense. They are athletes who didn't work out in other sports. That's true of a lot of them. Macho Man Randy Savage was a baseball player and it didn't work out there. Brock Lesnar, who's the current champion, was in the NFL and he was in Ultimate Fighting, MMA fighting, and UFC. So he's done those things and kind of arrived there. It's a lot of guys who, for whatever reason, they kind of didn't fit in other places, and in pro wrestling they can make it work. And so the trade-off with that is maybe there's not a whole lot else that they can do. This is it.
You said earlier that wrestling was once dominated by a series of regional promoters. How did Vince McMahon come to dominate the industry? He has the equivalent of a monopoly, doesn't he?
He essentially has a monopoly. There are competing, promoters still, but they're so much smaller that, it's not a real threat. But you do have groups like Ring of Honor or TNA, but the conditions are even worse there. Vince McMahon, so the NWA really persisted until the late 70s, and I kind of describe it as kind of a mafia in a sense. And then Vince McMahon in the late 70s, early 80s, just began destroying it systematically. And he did that, you have to almost admire him for how he did it, buying up regional promotions, paying guys to defect to his promotion, buying part ownerships and then again prompting defections. But the most important element in all of this, the one that really allowed him to conquer not just America but the world, was the rise of cable television and pay-per-view. And using that, you could trample over the old boundaries. There was no territories to respect with pay-per-view, which is why I think in part his really last competitor was Ted Turner, and even Ted Turner eventually was defeated.
And then his sister went into politics and she was defeated, but that's a whole other story.
Well, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, yeah, Linda McMahon spent an exceedingly large amount of money for two Senate races, which did not succeed. But Linda is also an important part of the story in terms of the deregulation. So she perhaps wasn't as hands off in the management as she later made out in the campaigns.
I'd like to play a clip of wrestler CM Punk giving a speech in 2011 in the ring in which he calls out the McMahons.
The reason I'm leaving is you people, because after I'm gone, you're still going to pour money into this company. I'm just a spoke on the wheel. The wheel's going to keep turning, and I understand that. But Vince McMahon's going to make money despite himself. He's a millionaire who should be a billionaire. You know why he's not a billionaire? It's because he surrounds himself with glad-handing, nonsensical yes-men.
He called himself a spoke on the wheel.
Yeah.
Are many wrestlers eager to speak out about their problems with the sport, or are they likely to be blacklisted if they criticize at all?
Yeah, it really depends. I think the ones who are most likely to speak out are the ones who know that they're never going back, that they have no chance of returning and earning a livelihood with the WWE, but. You know, the WWE has, I believe it's called the Legends contract, where they will contract, older WWE stars and provide them some modicum of income in their later years. Why would you jeopardize that? You know, why would you speak out about what you've seen when and jeopardize that? The fact is, you know, if the McMahons, if the WWE corporation doesn't want you in the building, you're not getting in the building.
Well, was that speech scripted? Was that done with the support of the McMahons?
It's very tricky to answer, because here again, this is the difficulty with wrestling. It's always hard to tell what's real and what's fake. In that case, it was what would be called a worked shoot, meaning it sounds like he's saying what he really thinks, but in reality, the McMahons are fine with it. Now, in that storyline, CM Punk was suspended for a week. It's not really clear how serious that was. He was back in any event, but it wasn't really clear how serious it was. Now, he did leave this year in a similar fashion, without that kind of send-off, but it seems quite genuine. And it seems like in this case, he really did, kind of tell the McMahons to hang. It's kind of like trying to interpret from the outside, North Korea or something like that. It's hard to tell what's real and what isn't.
No wrestlers were willing to speak with us today. What reasons did they give?
Yeah, I did reach out to several, and I fully respected the reasons that were given. The reasons were that, essentially, there was nothing that they wanted to do to jeopardize their relationship with the WWE, and I fully respect that. But I think it speaks to this pervasive kind of fear which governs the industry, because things aren't going to get better if nobody speaks out. With that said, I can offer nothing but respect to those wrestlers, because they have a tough enough situation as it is.
One name I was surprised to see in the story was Rick Santorum. What role has he played?
Yeah, Rick Santorum. Back in Pennsylvania, was an attorney who helped lobby for the deregulation of the sport in Pennsylvania. What that ultimately, about wrestling, pro wrestling is deregulated in about half the country. It goes state by state, and typically, what deregulation means is a lack of regulation of referees, timekeepers, often drug testing and often licensing of doctors. Rick Santorum in that case, I guess he's a big believer in the free enterprise system and viewed this as regulations that were unnecessary, and in exchange for a lobbying fee, was able to help them succeed in deregulating in Pennsylvania, which is also the state that supplied much of their steroids.
How did you get involved in this story?
I was actually, I should mention, I was not initially a wrestling fan going into this. I think to some degree possibly scoffed at this. I was asked by Jackabit Magazine, who were nice enough to ask me to give this a shot and look into it. And the more I dug into it, the more fascinated I was by it, the more, frankly, dirt there was. And I should mention that, you know, by the end of it, I was kind of a fan also. And, you know, I subscribe to the WWE Network now, which is the big thing. And, you know, I have to say I kind of, you know, kind of was taken by it.
And you learned a lot more than you expected to, but that's all. Money in the Bank is Dan O'Sullivan's article in Jacobin Magazine. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show.
Well, thank you for having me, Leonard. Really appreciate it.